Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 11th, 2006. I will be the host today. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the economic section of EIR News Service. And today, which is Veterans Day in the United States, is certainly a time to reflect on principles of the meaning of the United States as a republic in this very exciting and dangerous time we have after the November 7th elections. And we set the topic for today, and we said this before November 7th, would be the LaRouche factor following the midterm elections and the historic November 16th webcast that Mr. LaRouche is going to make in Washington, D.C., in tandem with Berlin, as an international event this coming Thursday. And so what we have today are four guests to discuss the situation we're in, and I want to introduce them. It's a cross-country group, and I'll begin, I'll welcome people, then I'll say very few things, and you'll see why. Because our first guest I'd like to welcome is Deborah Freeman from Maryland. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, how are you, Marcia?
I'm well, thank you.
I think we should all be well today.
Very well indeed.
Yes.
And Debbie, who many of you know very well from her hosting of the series of webcasts, well, that's been in here on stateside for Berlin and Washington, D.C. in recent months, but also, as you know, she is a spokesman for Mr. LaRouche and for the LaRouche Political Action Committee. And so in a very few minutes, she's going to lead off the whole discussion. But let me welcome to the show, to the panel we have of the LaRouche Youth Movement leaders coast to coast. I have here in the studio, I welcome Doug Mitchell. Hi.
Hi, Masha.
And Doug can chime in at any time, but he's been in the LaRouche Youth Movement's war room during the last run-up to the elections and during the whole excitement. But he, as you may have caught or not, is an international leader, Australian nationality.
Yes. I've been around for a long time. I've been in the U.S. a bit this year.
At the right time.
Yes.
And we welcome from Michigan then and from California, from Detroit, who's been right in on the action in Ohio and Michigan and elsewhere, Sharon Stevens. Hi.
Hello.
And from Northern California in Oakland, Ouyang Teng. Are you there? Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Thanks.
So I think that I'm just, Debbie, going to say a couple of nuts and bolts and things, and let's call it marching orders, although you can sound cadence for us in the rest of the hour. But since many people listen in during the week by telephone, as well as this being archived, I just stress that the November 16th webcast by Mr. LaRouche, the Washington-Berlin event internationally, is at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time, 1 p.m., and as you know, you can look for an announcement of that on our news service, which is LaRouchePub.com, but the full notification and where you can watch it is LaRouchePAC.com, LaRouchePAC.com, and the what you should also look for there, if you haven't already, or get otherwise hard copy, is something Mr. LaRouche put out on the day after the election, after he saw President Bush's response on November 8th. And Mr. LaRouche wrote his evaluation at that time called Bush Sings His Swan Song. 250,000 copies of that are being printed, most of them done now, by the LaRouche Political Action Committee, and I'll leave it to Debbie if she wants to stress anything about it, but you get the idea, and I urge you to take a look on the website or otherwise make a point of getting that in a hard copy. And finally, I just want to point out, people often want to know what Mr. LaRouche is up to personally, since he's always up to something, that he is in the process of writing a piece whose headline he calls Saving the U.S. Economy, A Design for Legislation. That's in the works. And later in the show, I might read a little from the beginning of it. The first line goes regarding, he's talking about Congress. As the saying goes, do not speak of the rope in the house of the hanged. It might be said, Do not speak of the onrushing global financial breakdown in the Houses of Congress. Nevertheless, the time has come to speak urgently of what had often in the past been considered to be unspeakable truths. That's a quote from this paper in the works. And the only other plug I make before turning things over to Debbie to really comment on our whole historic situation is that resources, resources, resources. The Doug Mitchell, who's here as soon as the show's finished, is going to Washington, D.C. There's a gathering on the East Coast of youth to be there to welcome Congress when they return on Monday and really stage a whole week of action here in Washington, D.C., and many things are happening internationally in tandem with this. And so you see why backing this, activating wherever you may be around the country or around the world is necessary. Debbie, what do you want to start with?
Well, I think that really to start, it's very important to just kind of locate what this victory really represents. Because, I've been through a lot of election campaigns. And in this particular campaign, on election day, I was at one of the Democratic Party headquarters in Washington, where calls were coming in. It was a troubleshooting site. Calls were coming in from around the country on the manner in which the election was being conducted. And, you know, I'm generally pretty reserved about this kind of stuff, but I have to admit that I was near panic because the onslaught of voter intimidation, machine malfunction, of what really looked like an impending vote fraud was overwhelming. By around, I would say it must have been around 11 o'clock in the morning, one of the people who was monitoring the radio stations came in and told us that Rush Limbaugh and a few of the other right-wing shock jocks had put out a call for listeners to jam the troubleshooting phone lines of the Department of Justice and the Democratic Party by using speed dialers. And no sooner were the words out of his mouth that the lines were in fact jammed. Now, what we found out subsequently is that the lines were not jammed by people using speed dialers. There was some professional equipment used, I'm not sure from where, that did in fact jam the lines. The reason why I'm going through all of this is because I think it's important to get a sense of what the mood is out there in the nation. Because on the one hand, there should not be any question in anyone's mind as to the fact that this administration and the synarchist apparatus behind them went to incredible lengths to try to win this election, or at least to try to limit the degree to which the Democrats would prevail. On the other side, it is also the case, and you know, I think that there are reasons for this that I'll identify. But the fact of the matter is that for the most part, while individual Democratic candidates absolutely earned their victories, and I know I saw here in Maryland a get-out-the-vote effort that continued up until 8 o'clock at night. It continued right up until the polls closed. The fact of the matter is that the Democrats nationally behaved in a way which was extremely sloppy. And the fact is that the defeat of the Cheney-Bush synarchist apparatus could have come and would have come in the form of a crushing landslide had these guys not, not succumbed in the way that they did to their absolutely thirsty desire for financial campaign contributions. It was very clear, and Mr. LaRouche stressed during the course of the campaign, because we were heavily involved in trying to energize and drive this campaign forward, and to drive it forward with a national program. That really was the role that the LaRouche youth movement played in focusing the principles that had to be addressed in this campaign was really outstanding. And it was conspicuously the only really loud voice that was ringing out. But see, one of the things that was affecting the Democrats and LaRouche really slammed them for this, was that if you look at kind of the right wing of the Democratic Party, and you look at the role of someone like Felix Rohatyn, who himself is not really such a great power, but who really does represent the Anglo-Dutch financial interests here in the United States. And Rohatyn was giving these guys some very bad advice. But that advice was coupled with a promise of financial campaign contributions, which they are obsessed with. And the basic message that he was putting out was that they shouldn't sound too democratic, that if they wanted to win the election, what they really had to do is they had to move to the center, they had to capture the Republican vote. I mean, it was just a rewarmed version of the nonsense, you know, that we heard during past presidential campaigns from groups like the Democratic Leadership Council. But what his real objective was, and this is easily understood if you understand that he does represent those financier circles, there was a clear indication, and we were getting it from some of the people who we work with in the Democratic Party, that this election could have been a crushing landslide in the making. And people like Rohatyn knew damn well that they couldn't stop the Democrats from winning. But what he deployed himself to ensure was that it would not be a landslide, that the Democrats would win their majority in the House and in the Senate, but that it would be a relatively narrow majority, that it would not be a veto-proof majority. And by doing that, you do two things. One is that you virtually ensure chaos in terms of the day-to-day functioning of the government, because you have a Congress and an administration at odds with each other. But what you also do is you basically cede control to the bankers, which is essentially the problem that we've had during this whole past 2-year period. And that was the objective. Now, in terms of the victory that was won, I think the fact that the Democrats did prevail in a historic victory, the fact that you now have Democratic control in both the House and the Senate, and you have it with the Republicans having gone all out and with the Democrats, frankly, having run a half-assed campaign, I think that gives you some idea of the mood of the country. And right now, in the same way that Mr. LaRouche intervened during the Democratic convention in 2004 and energized John Kerry's campaign. And I should add, Marcia, this is recognized by key people inside the Democratic Party. They know, and they will readily admit, that up until that convention, when Lynn moved in there with over 100 members of the LaRouche Youth Movement and just flooded the city of Boston with a campaign platform, which up to then the Democrats did not have. Up to that point, John Kerry's campaign was nowhere. It was going straight downhill. And as a result of that intervention, what we saw was a transformation of the Kerry campaign and a truly energized campaign. Now, unfortunately, it was too little too late. But without LaRouche's intervention, the fact of the matter is that would not have been a campaign at all. As it was a campaign that went right down to the wire, and clearly the only way that Bush won a second term was through massive vote fraud and voter suppression. LaRouche intervened again in a webcast that he did just after the election, just after the presidential election, when the Democratic Party was, to say that they were on the floor, I mean, these guys were completely demoralized and in disarray. And with a webcast that began immediately after the election and continued in a series of three webcasts leading right up to certification, once again, Lynn energized the party, got them in fighting shape, and if people remember, Bush was virtually rendered a lame duck before he was even certified for his second term. Now, this time out, LaRouche played the same role, and there is no question that the activity of the LaRouche Youth Movement basically shamed the Democrats into making a fight in this election. We were looking at one hell of a mess in the spring because the Democrats were factionalized. They were not addressing the central issues. There were real questions as to who was on what side. But the limb was consistent. They were visible. They were gutsy, and it changed the tenor of the campaign. Now we've won that victory, but I think that that it has to be clear that that victory is really just the first step. And I know that in meetings that I've had this week, and I know it's going to be the message of the limb during their week of action in D.C. beginning on Monday. Is that the Democratic caucus on both sides of the Capitol, both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, have said to us repeatedly, yes, you're right about what has to be done in the economy. Yes, Lyndon LaRouche's Emergency Reconstruction Act is wonderful. Yes, Bush and Cheney, you know, have committed impeachable offenses, but you know, we're just the poor Democrats. We don't have the votes. They have the majority. They are so mean. They don't care what we say. We've asked for an investigation. We've asked for this. We've asked for that. They just ignore us. You know, and I mean, if we had more violin players, we could accompany this. But the bottom line is that now they don't have any excuses anymore. The excuses are gone. They've got the votes. They've got the votes in the House. They've got the votes in the Senate. And it's time that they took the action that was long overdue. And that action has to be a multi-pronged offensive that includes the removal of Cheney and Bush from office, because this nation is not going to survive unless that's done. And it means removing them from office as removing the obstacle to actually beginning what we have got to do, and what, I mean, the hour for this is already very, very late. But we have to begin to organize a recovery from this ongoing crash. And Lynn is, LaRouche is the person who knows how to do this. I know that is going to be the theme of the webcast on Thursday.
I guess this paper is looking towards that then.
Yes,
you had
it is.
Said that, sorry. Uh-huh.
It absolutely is. The paper that you mentioned, along with a few other documents that he's cooking up, really are the basis for this. And I can't stress enough that the period between this webcast and January, when this Congress, this new Congress comes in, is probably one of the single most important periods in American history. And the tone is going to be set by what LaRouche does, by what the youth movement does. And you know, Marcia, one thing that I would really stress to people who are listening, mm-hmm. is that in order for us to do this, to do what's necessary in this period, and clearly the population's ready for it, but in order for us to really maximize this effort, we are painfully short on money and manpower. Now, on the manpower question, while we're short on manpower, the manpower that we do have in the LaRouche Youth Movement is probably the best on-the-ground fighting force that you're going to find anywhere in the world right now. But we need to give those young people and Mr. LaRouche the flexibility that is necessary to deploy on a dime, right? They have to be able to respond to whatever it is that occurs between now and January, and not only to respond, but also to initiate. And that is going to take a much greater influx of resources than we have now. And I think that one excellent way for all of the people who worked with us during this campaign, for all of the people who I know have given generously, during the course of these last few months, this really is the time. They should celebrate this historic victory by making sure that this movement has the resources that it needs to take this thing forward now to a final victory. And that does mean, it's not vague at all, it means money. We need money. And that money is probably the best money that people can possibly spend. They'll get a lot more bang for their buck by giving money to this movement than anything else. But I think people will get a taste of, another taste of what the LIM is capable of in Washington this week. And I want to really encourage people. Lynn right now has a track record with these pre and post election webcasts. They are some of the most dynamic and effective presentations that he gives. And if people cannot actually make it into Washington to participate in it live, then they should by all means organize meetings and gatherings everywhere. On the campus, in libraries, in their homes. But this is going to be an event that people simply do not want to miss.
That's right. Let me just say, we have Richard T. from Texas has sent an email. I'm going to hold that a minute, but get to it. Debbie, it's naturally pursuing more about impeachment, which you threw out, but we'll get back to that. But do Sharon, Doug, or Ouyang, I'm going to open up one, either throw in a question here to Debbie or an observation along the lines of what she was saying, including about the election day or the run-up to that. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I've got a question. This is Ouyang in Oakland.
Yeah.
I'm sort of wondering, given the fact that you've got, you've got with the Democrats taking the Congress, you've got some of these guys in the House that are taking these important chairmanships. They're pretty interesting characters who have done some good things and have worked with us. You have on the other side, I don't know, other people, maybe Pelosi, I don't know who exactly, and the Roatan influence inside the party. And I'm kind of wondering where that particular fight stands, and if the fact that you've got some better people that are going to be in positions of power, is that a way to bypass it, or how directly does it have to be taken on right now to get an impeachment, for example?
Well, I'll tell you what I know. I know that there was a conference call, a teleconference on Thursday, I believe, which included the incoming chairs of all the committees, the incoming Democratic chairs of all the committees. And, the line that the Roatan crowd is putting out is that we don't want to make the mistake that Newt Gingrich made. In whenever the hell that was, right? And when you had the conservative revolution and the Gingrichites came in the midterm,
94,
right? Yeah. Right, 1994. Because for people who, I mean, some of our LIM members may not even remember what went on then, but what Gingrich essentially did was, Clinton was president, the Republicans won a majority. And they basically paralyzed the government for a period of 2 years until the elections came around again and they were kicked out of office. Now, what is being said by the Roatan boys is they're saying, well, we don't want to make that mistake. We want to show that we're not obstructionists. we should just take all this talk of impeachment off the table. Otherwise, we'll be booted out too. And, you know, and we don't want that to happen. Now, interestingly, they made that pitch on this call, and you know, I was listening to it. I was ready to explode. But in fact, a number of leading Democrats responded very well and said that, number one, there was no comparison at all, because they reminded people that the Gingrichites were paralyzing the government of a president who was arguably more popular than any president since Franklin Roosevelt. And they were paralyzing the government with pernicious policies. Here you have a situation which is quite different. You have a U.S. population clamoring for a change in policy, and you have a presidency which has a higher disapproval rating than any president in the entire history of the United States, including Richard Nixon, who was hounded out of office. So what they said is, sorry, that's, you know, we don't buy that. And it was made very clear by a number of people, including Representative Waxman, including Senator Rockefeller, and several others, that these investigations, these subpoenas, are long overdue, that this investigation has to go forward, and that there really is not going to be any compromise on that. And it was a big fight. There was an argument. But the result of the argument was that they prevailed. You see, the fact right now is that you've got a situation where the mandate is there and everybody knows it. And one of the points that Lynn's made over and over again is that in order to push this kind of stuff through, you don't need every member of the Democratic caucus. What you need is a small group of tenacious people who will actually fight this thing through based on the principle. And, you know, there's an interesting piece in the current issue of Vanity Fair, which I don't think has hit the newsstands yet. But one of the things that it goes through is that Cheney in particular is going to be deluged with subpoenas and different investigations, because the questions that are immediately on the table, you know, are the questions surrounding the pre-war intelligence, questions about the role of these Halliburton contracts, not only in Iraq, but also the role that Halliburton played in stealing money in the Gulf Coast reconstruction in the aftermath of Katrina. There are going to be investigations as to energy policy and Cheney's secret energy commission. This is going to be such an onslaught that there are some people who are saying that it may never even come to impeachment, that Cheney may be hounded out of office in the very early days. But again, I think that really does depend on us. You know, certainly if it were up to Nancy Pelosi, is not what she would do. But Nancy Pelosi is above all else a pragmatist. And she knows that as speaker, she's not a House speaker with the strongest support. She knows that if she wants to hold on to that position, that she is going to have to reconcile with some of the more militant members of the party. And that's just where it stands right now. I think, though, that it really does come down to what we do. We have to make this issue very clear, and we have to make clear that this is not, that the question of the impeachment of these guys is not simply because they've committed impeachable offenses around the Iraq War, but because the entire manner in which they've conducted themselves has been contrary to the most fundamental principles of the U.S. Constitution, and that this country will not survive unless they're booted from office. And we have to be way out in front of
of what anybody else is going to do on this. And we have to be clear that it's going to be us that actually lays kind of the foundation of principle on which this fight is made. Now, we've already come a long way on that. But I can guarantee that that when this new Congress comes in, this administration is going to be deluged with subpoenas and investigations. Now, I know that today Congressman Waxman did something which is kind of amusing, which is that he said that since he's going to do this when he takes over the chairmanship, that he was going to ask the current chairman of the committee, who's of course a Republican, to issue the subpoenas now, so that
next week or Monday or something.
Yes, right. He's saying, you know, it would really be better to save time, and you know, it's going to happen anyway. So why don't you just go ahead and do it? You know, and that'll be our first bipartisan act. I don't think they're going to go for it, but it's the right move. You know, and it sets absolutely the right tone. But it's, you know, I don't think Pelosi is the best choice as House Speaker. But with that, you know, given that that's the way it is, I don't think that it's going to be I really don't think it's going to be a major obstacle for us. I think we can do just fine.
Debbie, I'll throw in here the emailer from Texas. You already hit on this, so I'll just identify this emailer's point. Richard was asking you about Pelosi because the fact that it's being bandied about that she personally said on last week that impeachment is off the table. You already addressed that dynamic. And secondly, though, he asks you, Ralph Nader, for example, is played up on November 8th, is saying you are going to have all these legal subpoenas, but you could get a gridlock where, given who Bush and Cheney are, you'll just have Fortress White House, and they'll invoke presidential powers anyway, etc. Now, I think you've already replied to that. Hold that thought a minute. I have to say, at the halftime point in the show, which this is November 11th, that you are listening to The LaRouche Show, and we are weekly at from 3 to 4 p.m. live every Saturday on LaRouchePub.com. And we listen in again November 18th, which will follow the November 16th historic Washington-Berlin webcast by Mr. LaRouche at 1 p.m. Eastern Savings Daylight Time. And that is on LaRouchePAC.com. Okay, Debbie, anything more on this impeachment dynamic, or you've
said
it?
Well, I do want to respond. I mean, you know, you listen to people like Ralph Nader, and it's really, aside from the fact that it's the most disgusting kind of cynicism, it's the equivalent of saying we can't have a revolution because the czar won't let us.
I guess that's why it's on TV.
We can't have a revolution because it's against the law. I mean, this is absurd. This administration is going to be hit with an onslaught. And it's not just a question of an onslaught from the Congress. You have massive institutional opposition. Look at what's going on in the military on this question of the Iraq War. You know, I think that Ralph Nader probably would have said that there was no possible way that you were going to get rid of Donald Rumsfeld. And he could say that to the back of Rumsfeld's head as Rumsfeld, you know, leaves town. I mean, there's no question that we can get this done. And the question of the subpoenas is just the first step. It really is just the first step. I don't think that you can look at this, you know, from the standpoint of procedure and whether or not they're going to try to invoke executive power. I would point out that that is exactly what Richard Nixon did. And I would also point out that Richard Nixon was not impeached. He didn't have to be impeached. He was driven out of office before he was impeached. So I'm not, you know, I mean, Ralph Nader is aside from being a cynic, he's a classic Trotskyist, and thank goodness the direction of the country doesn't depend on an idiot like him.
Right. In fact, he got his credentials because he made a point that cars, automobiles should be safe. Well, in fact, we're not making any cars, and we're going to reindustrialize again. So much for him, and no wonder he's on TV.
That's right.
But with that, please crosstalk here. We do that on the show, if anyone wants to interrupt or jump in. But I thought we might go to segue into Sharon, who's in Detroit, spent a lot of time in Ohio. And Sharon, you went after the elections out to campuses, but even before the elections, on the issue of impeachment. Do you want to throw in anything here or maybe make a different point about the mood and the engagement you're seeing?
Yeah, sure. The it is the same thing that's already been brought up. The question is definitely what next? What is the Congress going to do next? For the Midwest, where it is completely impoverished, the question of the economy is first and foremost on everybody's mind. But regarding the youth vote, somebody took a poll, or I forget where I heard it, but one of the primary reasons that young people came out was because somebody spoke to them. They gave the reason that someone gave them a reason to go out. And as we organize on the streets, this is what we've been leading, where we have to change history, that young people have to take the responsibility to have the moral courage to go after what's wrong, because it's our future that's at stake. So we prick the conscience of the population. And it's funny because we're going to be going into Washington, D.C. with, an agenda that for the Congress, both houses, that this is the time to be bold. You know, we need a new monetary system, and we need the impeachment of Dick Cheney. And if these two things aren't the issues that are going to be addressed immediately, then you have to challenge, we have to challenge whether or not these individuals are actually qualified to lead the country. So the horizon is LaRouche's webcast, because the title of this webcast is The Policy Solutions to the Great Crash of 2007.
Right. Do you want to, Doug is here, he's in the war room and seeing all this shape up. Do you want to say anything more about reactions, as Sharon brought out, even in this country or elsewhere? You were involved in Germany, in fact.
Yes, I've been in Berlin in the last 6 months with the youth movement there, which is growing, which is building up a network, which is getting out LaRouche's webcasts and writings en masse, and educating the German population about LaRouche. And LaRouche had a discussion recently with the German limb about the principle of the mass effect in organizing the population, in getting literature out there, getting ideas out onto the street. And he made the point that when you do distribute literature in an environment, after a while, the population starts to discuss the ideas with you and amongst themselves and starts to get a sense of what to do. And I think what I've been seeing this week in the war room with the different reports coming in from Missouri, we had a squad of 7 organizers out there for the campaign, is that we were going to a lot of areas where we hadn't been before. And we were going onto campuses. This was also the case in Connecticut. We were going onto campuses, going into student unions, and saying, look, we want to show this webcast. It's important. It's a week before the election. We want to impeach Bush and Cheney. It's about the economic crisis. And we were having very rigorous discussions with members of student unions on these campuses and organizing them around what LaRouche is doing. And what we're finding, from what I can see, is there's a real lack of political activity on these campuses, which we've exposed with the Is Joseph Goebbels on your Campus pamphlet. But if you look at the youth vote, there was a... this was monitored by a think tank, and in 6 states, I think it was Ohio, Michigan, Missouri, Connecticut, Tennessee, and I can't remember the other one, but In those six states alone, Colorado, there was a 157% increase in the youth vote, or it was that percentage higher than the youth turnout in other areas. And three of those states, the LaRouche Youth Movement campaigned in. In Missouri, we had over 50 contacts over the period of 1 week come in and watch LaRouche's webcast. So I think that shows, you know, to the people that are listening, that this principle of mass organizing the population, of organizing around ideas, is what is going to really develop and create a more powerful mood in the nation to fight harder with their congressmen for impeachment. And I think the point Debbie made about the fact that this next 2 to 3 month period before the Congress reconvenes around Bush's State of the Union address is the most critical is exactly right. We have to get movements on the economy, you know, on reconstruction of the economy, on a bankruptcy reorganization. And this is what LaRouche emphasizes in this paper. But
I think, though, there's one important point also to stress, which is that in this election, you know, if you look at the number of people who were registered to vote between 2004 and 2006, for this election, there wasn't voter registration was not any higher than it was in 2004. What you had was you had a much larger voter turnout. And there are a number of polls that have been done by these various, you know, voting pattern analyses outfits that all show the same thing, that the difference in the vote was the youth vote. You had an across the board increase in the number of young people voting and, you know, the vast majority of them. Voted Democrat. It also is the case, and this is actually very interesting, when they talk about the youth vote, they talk about voters between the ages of 18 and 28. But they did a second slice, a second statistical slice, which were voters between the ages of 25 and 35. And you had actually more voters in that age bracket than any other single age bracket. And the point that that Lynn made when we were going over some of these numbers is that that actually represents a section of the population that came of age during the 8 years of the Clinton administration. And they don't have, not that Clinton was so great, but they don't have the same sense of cynicism. And that age group energized largely by the organizing of the LIM. And what the LIM did, just you can't just look at it from the standpoint of what states they were in. The fact is that what they did in key population centers reverberated all over the country. And we have, you know, we have the demographics to show that. But it really, you know, I think that that it's a crucial phenomena. And it's one that really is, it's changing the shape and the contours of politics in the United States. And that's something that probably some people are very dismayed about, because it's a section of the vote that is very hard to control. You can buy off, you know, and this is just an unfortunate fact. We saw it during the presidential campaign. You can buy off a minority vote. You know, look at the role that the faith-based initiative has played, but you can't buy off the youth vote. It's a section of the population that is difficult to control. The way that they've tried to control it up to now is with this brainwashing, politically correct dictatorship that they've run on the campuses. I mean, they have a virtual Gestapo apparatus that operates on major campuses. And one of the things that the youth did very, very effectively is they began to just bust up that apparatus. And, you know, in the last days of the campaign, you know, things got pretty nasty. in some places. But they got nasty precisely because the youth were so effective in ripping away the mask of this on-campus Gestapo. And once you rip that away, then, you know, what happens on campus is up for grabs. You rip away that brainwashing control, and you're going to see young people stepping forward and demanding control of their future. And that's bad news for the bankers in the United States.
Debbie, that takes us, one of the places that can take us to is California.
Yes.
And Ouyang might want to say, there are many things, that's wild, time is fleeting here on this 1 hour, but we have 14 minutes. But Ouyang, you're right there in the middle. You have the Ayn Rand Institute based, I guess, in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a whole nest of operatives that have been spinning this web of control across the country, right? And you really, do you want to describe this or make other points about Schwarzenegger?
No, I mean, it's useful to see the way LaRouche described how it is that we actually create an effect with the organizing. I think this is a discussion with the Berlin youth. And, you know, because he said that you're effectively trying to bypass this kind of media, he called it the interpretation of unreality that people get through the media. And that sort of dictates the terms of the discussion that people are willing to have, you know, when it comes to politics or anything else. And what you see in what we did in Connecticut, or what we did with the Ayn Rand Institute guys in California, is not so much a question of presenting something that you want somebody to agree with on the face, you know, on the face of it, but you change the terms in which people are willing to engage discussion, and that you actually get people oriented around something that's real. And it's sort of, we had a discussion here, you know, post-election to sort of say, okay, well, what's the outlook after the election? That, you know, we're looking at a period where it's going to be now on us to put forward the solution in a way that's not simply saying, well, we've got a piece of legislation that now this new Congress should take up. But, you know, if you take a cue from the Berlin webcast last week, that it's, again, this question of changing the fundamental axioms around things like economics. And, I mean, I'm kind of interested to see if people are more keen on a higher conception of the solution now that they don't have this underdog mentality when it comes to politics. And I don't know if what people have been finding around the country on that. But, you know, we want to accelerate the work on you know, this Kepler project that we've been doing as a lead-in to the next phase of the animations work, and, you know, sort of see if now in the environment of a democratic majority you can actually get a breakthrough, a conceptual breakthrough in terms of economics. But it's right now everything seems sort of in the air. It seems very, I mean, in one sense it's clear the direction we have to go, but in another sense it seems somewhat ambiguous how people are going to respond to this shift from the underdog to, you know, having some amount of responsibility for the ideas that are going to be carried forward into the next 50 years.
Right. We could, anyone want to jump in to respond? I had that on my list of questions in advance for Debbie, too, about the what we're up against in the way of the crazy axioms of the crazy economics.
Well, you know, there's the craziness and the embrace of irreality usually occurs and becomes endemic in the population, in any case, when they don't have anything positive to hold on to. And we saw that, you know, in the mobilization around Lynn's Emergency Reconstruction Act. It's really, do you have a problem with people, you know, not understanding economics, with people no longer understanding, you know, why it's important to produce? Yeah, of course you do. But the fact of the matter is that as this as the effects of this collapse become more and more difficult to escape. And, you know, it was very interesting. On Thursday night, a former Treasury Secretary Rubin spoke before the Economics Club in Washington, D.C. And, you know, he delivered some statements that people were extremely upset about. But he was very direct. And he said, look, I'm telling you right now, he said, we have an impending catastrophe on our hands. He said the first thing that this Congress should do is they should roll back Bush's tax cut, because if they don't do it, we are not going to be able to meet even the most minor obligations of keeping this government functioning day to day. And he made very clear in what was a very sober assessment that the U.S. and in fact the financial system as a whole has been kept afloat with the constant influx of foreign dollars, and that's coming to an end. And that they have to face that fact now. Now, you know, the fact of the matter is that a rollback of Bush's tax cut, while undoubtedly it should take place, and it should take place in short order, is not going to solve the economic problems of the nation. But when you have somebody like Rubin, who is the master of understatement, sounding an alarm in that way, when you have the housing bubble exploding in the way that it is, or imploding in the way that it is, I think the question of taking on people's axioms is going to be a lot less difficult. I think that the key thing is that you just have to, you know, my policy is no compassion for the bankers, but you do have to have some compassion for the population, because they don't know what real economics is. I mean, the vast majority of people who are alive today were born, you know, into a post-industrial America. They don't know anything about what real economy is or how it should function. And our job really is to show them. I really have never been more confident that we can do that than I am now. The response that we're getting, and also the fact that LaRouche's credibility is just so high right now because of the events of the last couple of months, but then the events of the last few years, that outside of, you know, the kind of dirty operations that somebody like Felix Rohatyn, you know, tries to run, I don't really think there's anybody who's too anxious to challenge Lynn, not on questions of economics.
You're right. I you don't see a lot of the population, if they're given the real choice, which the limb, which all of LaRouche's effort, they're not going to run in the arms of Schwarzenegger, Felix Rohatyn, and Al Gore to worry about global warming.
Of course, and we just defeated the argument that you can't do anything.
Yes.
Obviously, you can.
That's it.
And because that's what the vast majority of the problem that we face is not that people say, I disagree with you. People say, I agree, but I don't really think you can do it.
Yeah.
Well, we did do it.
Right. And we did it in different places. Doug or Sharon, did you have something to throw in here?
Well, I just wanted to talk about the week of action, and maybe Sharon can come in as well, because we've had a lot of discussion about it in the last few days. But with Lynn's new statement, this is really addressing the question of a bankruptcy reorganization of immediate legislation now for a credit creation in the economy for infrastructure development. And I think this is what we're going to be addressing in Washington, D.C. next week, into the Congress, you know, into the population, onto the campuses, and looking to get as many people as possible who are in the area. And if you are in the greater D.C. area, then you should come to this webcast, because it is going to be a crucial intervention for the Democratic Party to give them the leadership by which they have to take the next step forward. And yes, we must get the impeachment of Cheney and Bush done very quickly, into motion straight away. But we have to get the Congress, we have to start to educate these legislators about the reality on the economy, and I think more so educate them as to what a real productive economy is.
We do have to do that, but I would just point out that sometimes their education is rapidly accelerated at the heel of a boot or the end of the noose. And that's something that you just have to keep in mind. I mean, because the legislation part is easy once you have the muscle behind it. And that's really what it comes down to. And you know, it's really about making clear that there isn't going to be any compromise on this. And that, in a sense, you know, the American people have spoken. And, you know, I think that it's going to be very interesting because, you know, in the Senate, remember, it was only one-third of the Senate that was up for re-election. The other two-thirds of the Senate, will all be in church on Sunday, you know, thanking God that they weren't up for re-election. But they also, you know, they witnessed what happened. And I think that this whole question of maintaining control of the administration's ability to maintain control over the Republican caucus, et cetera, forget it, it's out the window. This is anybody's ball game. And I think we just really, you know, we have to be prepared in the boldest and most unconventional way, you know, to just flex some muscle and to have a good time doing it. And, you know, the legislation, and that's the easy part. You know, we can provide legislation well into the next century. But what we've got to do is we need some, you know, fertilizer for these guys to, you know, to grow a pear. And that really is what it comes down to.
And so, Sharon, you may want to say something else, but since you were there in Ohio, where you had the Delphi plant shutting down, Indiana and elsewhere too, and do you, on this issue of no compromise, how do you see things going pretty strongly on this?
Yeah, people are pretty mobilized. But to reiterate kind of what Doug was saying, it is going to take a quality of education where, you know, we have to challenge where value lies, whether it lies in the kinds of ideas ennobling us to improve the lives per capita, per, you know, square, whatever, increasing the development of the mind to think clearly. That's the biggest problem, is that people don't know how to think, to give them a purpose in life, to improve the physical production. This is where the Midwest becomes key, right, in the development of ideas to transcend into the future, which is going to be determined by scientific and economic success. So people have to realize that the whole agenda around the physical collapse has to be addressed, right? Which do we choose to replace the cycle? Is it going to be fascism and what Bush Cheney represent, greed and insanity, or is it going to be agape and humanity?
And Debbie and others, that's what this so-called California way, that's what it's called. This Schwarzenegger, he's the figurehead for this stuff, went to Mexico and ran into the LaRouche Youth mm-hmm. Movement there with a vengeance in Mexico City, right, who confronted him. But
poor
that's
Arnie.
Yeah, that's right. that's the expression of the kind of Felix Rohat and George Shultz teaming up, I presume.
Yeah, exactly.
And, in the shadows.
Well, they're not in the shadows anymore.
No place.
They may like it there in dark, damp places, but sorry, guys. This is the era of sunshine. And, you know, and this is, you know, the more you shine a light on this stuff, I mean, we see how they're reacting. And, people in the United States they're at a point right now where they have to decide what kind of a country they want and what kind of a future they want, what kind of a future they want to leave their children. And, I mean, our population has lots of problems, but I think that ultimately, if provided with options,
that they will make the right choice. It's just a question of our ability to actually get out there and educate. And I really don't think, I mean, I think that to the degree that the LaRouche Youth Movement has access to the population and has a certain flexibility of deployment, there's no doubt in my mind that that they can organize the kind of popular movement for these, you know, that demands these kinds of policies. And the fact is that under those conditions, the rate at which you can educate people is tremendously accelerated. People learn faster in periods of great social ferment. There's no question about that. History has proven that to us again and again. And that ferment is there, and we just have to, we have to step into the fray. But I mean, Marcia, before I hop off,
the closing moment, and I'm glad to hear it. Go right ahead.
I cannot stress enough. I mean, our listeners, you've seen the LaRouche Youth Movement in action. You hear the depth and the commitment that they express every time they're given the opportunity to speak. And I think that it is our responsibility to make sure that the resources are there to maximize their effectiveness. And again, I mean, you know, this year is going to be over very soon, so that if people have not yet given the maximum contribution that they by law can give to LPAC, this is the time to do it. And if they have given the maximum contribution, then they should go out and find somebody else who has not, and they should organize them to do it. But there's a lot riding on this, and I think that we've proven in this last period that the money is very well spent.
That's it, and that is the best note to end on, and do it right away, everything the lady says. And we look forward to seeing you, Debbie, on November 16th, when you will be hosting the Washington, D.C. event for Mr. LaRouche, the webcast, at 1 p.m. Eastern Savings Time, and you know that's LaRouchePAC.com, and you can find notices of that on our publication website, LaRouchePub.com. And I want to thank you, Debbie Freeman, and Doug, and Sharon, and Ouyang. And this is the end of the LaRouche Show, November 11th. Thank you very much. Listen November 18th as well.
Thank you, Marcia. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.